Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
This is Protecting Project Pulp, episode 41. I'm your host, Simon Hildebrandt. Welcome to the show. This week we bring you The Queen of Wheats, published anonymously, narrated by Brandy Tarvin. This episode marks my 10th as host of PPP, and I'd like to dedicate this mini-anniversary to my wonderful wife Amanda. Steadfast chef, brewer, and domestic goddess of our little household, Mandy is also a podcaster in her own right, with the excellent Rompod, soon to return for its second season of romance goodness. Check it out at rompod.com. Thank you for supporting me in my hosting duties, and in everything else. And speaking of talented and capable women, actor, editor, and author Brandy Tarvin published her first story in the Transformers Legends anthology, based on the popular toy series. She works as a freelance author for Catalyst Game Labs, writes for Shadowrun the role-playing game, is content editor for Penumbra eMag, and has written dozens of original short stories. As an actor and model, Brandy has narrated industrial films, played extra roles in pilot TV series, and played numerous roles in community theatre. In addition to her work for Protecting Project Pulp, she has narrated stories for Starship Sofa. Follow Brandy on Twitter, at wannabewriter06, and check out her website at www.brandytarvin.com. Finally, to round out this anniversary celebration, I'm also updating the artwork on the site, a lovely piece of Art Deco called Icarus, by artist Rodolfo Reyes. Born and raised in Mexico City, Rodolfo is a freelance designer with a bachelor's degree in graphic design. He's created posters for short films and paid tribute to several movies in his artwork. He's also illustrated several book covers. Having mastered a characteristic Art Deco style, he's always looking to experiment with diverse styles and tools, drawing inspiration from the likes of Maurice Cassandre, Saul Bass, Drew Struzan, and several contemporary colleagues. You can find his artwork on DeviantArt at rodolforever.deviantart.com. He also has a gallery on Tumblr at rodolforever.tumblr.com, and his prints are available at darkcitygallery.com. Links are all in the show notes. So, ever wonder about the lives of the people working the counter at your local coffee shop? If so, then I think you'll enjoy The Queen of Wheats, narrated by Brandy Tarvin.
My breath came quickly. I could feel my cheeks burning like fire. But still he watched me. I looked up and met his eyes through the pane of glass, thoughtful brown eyes in a grave face that sent a wild pulse quivering in my throat. He wasn't the usual type of man who watched me through the window. He didn't try to smile at me, to ogle me. Just looked at me gravely with those intense brown eyes.
"Look out, kid, they'll burn,"
I heard someone hiss at my elbow.
I was back again. Back with my feet on the white tiled floor, in the white starched dress and the cap with its flaring wings. With the white cotton glove on my right hand and the row 3 deep, 10 long, of wheat cakes. Wheat cakes that I was dipping, turning, flipping with the light turn of my wrist on thick white plates. He'd be gone by now. I looked up. I saw him turn slowly in at the revolving door, seat himself at the long table with its marble top, and pull off his gloves. "Say, kid, what do you think you're doing? This ain't no Isle of Dreams. This is a pancake palace."
Thus Joe, in a kind, harsh voice at my elbow.
"I'm sorry, Joe, I'm..."
"Tired? Better take a turn at the tables."
I pulled off my white glove mechanically, drew off my stiff cap, and faced him timidly.
"Thank you, Joe," I faltered.
But now that I was face to face with romance, I felt I could go no further. Across there in the corner, underneath the white clock, beneath the nickel hooks for coats, sat the man with the brown eyes. And I was afraid. I felt my heart pounding louder. I put my hand to the ticket puncher at my belt
and went over to the table in the corner. Your order?
He looked up.
His eyes were just as brown as I had thought them, and a trifle sad. His cheeks were thin and bronzed, and when he spoke, his voice was like velvet.
Brown velvet. Wheat cakes and coffee.
But I had not been a waitress for 3 months for nothing. I knew that his gray suit was tailor-made, not bought in a store. I had seen his fine brown hands, the freshness of his linen, the cigarette box he had opened, set with a monogram and shining jewels. I lay down his wheat cakes, syrup, butter, coffee, as softly as I could. My fingers shook.
Do you like it? He said suddenly.
Like it? My eyes filled with tears. In all those lonely months, he was the first one who had asked me that. I shook my head, tried to wipe away a tear with the back of my hand, but he saw me.
You're different, he said slowly.
It was then that it came to me, the great, the terrible lie. Why shouldn't I pretend to be different? Why shouldn't I let him think that I wasn't just Maisie, who lived in a dark room beneath the thunder of the elevated trains with the smell of cooking and airless rooms and the screams of children down the hall?
How do you know? I whispered.
Then I stood up stiffly. It would never do to let anyone see. I might lose my job, my precious job. And jobs were scarce now. When I came back to give him his ticket, he asked me, without raising his eyes,
"Would you tell me your name?"
"Not now," I said. I watched him go. I saw him shrug into his coat and pick up his stick, catch his soft hat by the crown, and go toward the door. I wanted to go, too. To tell him my name. Oh, what had I done? I would never see him again, this wonderful man with the brown eyes that made my heart beat faster, with a voice that sent a wild thrill through my breast. I was very tired when I was through at last. My feet ached. My head drummed with the constant rattling noise of spoons and forks and knives crashing together, so that when I struck the icy air, I was almost dizzy. I had $5 left to live on next week. I needed a new pair of shoes. I ought to pay Mrs. Flynn tonight. But I would do neither of those things. I went into the first store that I saw, with a great aisle blazing with light and velvet soft beneath my feet. "I want a monogrammed handkerchief."
"Monograms, miss. You'll have to order that," the black silk salesgirl said scornfully.
"I want it now. Any monogram." I felt my cheeks burn at her scrutiny.
"Well, there's a few here returned," she said, and drew forth a handkerchief with the initials RLF.
"That will do." I paid two of my precious dollars for it, tucked it carefully away into my battered handbag, and went to the perfume counter. My heart thumped as I laid out my last $3 for a vial long as my finger that held 10 drops of perfume. It was French, and it bore the name of a famous perfumer. I had spent my last cent. I had to walk the 40 blocks home. I called it home. When I first came to New York, I thought it was wonderful to have money of my own, and a room of my own, and a home of my own. But I had been here 3 months now. I knew what it was to cry myself to sleep, to wake in the night with my pillow wet with tears, longing for someone, just anyone, to speak to. But I went to sleep that night with
Perhaps he'll laugh. The little crushed paper napkin that he had held in his fingers, beneath my pillow. When I touched it, he was near me. I could almost feel his eyes looking deep into mine. All next day I waited tremulously for him. Every time a man with a gray coat passed, my breath came fast. No, he wasn't coming back. Then, at 7 o'clock, he came. He took his place at the same table while my heart raced madly and I burned a row of wheat cakes. "Joe, will you let me go? Just tonight, Joe," I whispered.
"You'll lose your job, kid, if they ever get onto this," he growled.
But he shoved on the white glove and took the pitcher full of batter from me.
"I don't want anything to eat. I just want to look at you," said the man with the brown eyes. "I've been thinking of you all day. Don't run away, please. Your eyes are like gray mist, and your hair is like a cloud, and your little mouth... There, forgive me. If you'll just smile at me, I won't say it again."
While I went to get his coffee and wheat cakes, the blood drummed in my ears. All the rattle and crash of China had become like a chorus of beauty. "I've been thinking of you all day," I said it over and over again in my heart. I punched his ticket and went back to him. I slipped the handkerchief, with its drop of French perfume, out of my bosom and dropped it carelessly down on the table.
"Tomorrow's Sunday. May I come to see you, meet your mother, and tell her..."
I thought of the black hallway with the gas wheezing faintly, and the stairs with the ragged carpet. Oh, the smell of dust and cooking that drifted through those halls, and my own room, dark and airless, with its narrow white cot. "No, no, no," I whispered. "I'll meet you somewhere."
"At the museum at 3?
I answered yes under my breath and left him. It was not until he was gone that I remembered my handkerchief. That was gone with him. What did he want of a little girl like me? I was the queen of wheats. That's what they called me. Joe and the boys who dished the soup and poured the coffee behind the counters. Queen of wheats. And he was a gentleman. They didn't marry girls like me. I knew enough for that. But just once, just tomorrow, that would be the last time I'd see him. Unless I let him think that I was different, too. I'd have to make him think it. I tended Mrs. Flynn's baby, and she gave me a scrap of satin. I sat up until 2 that morning making a hat that crushed down over my hair. I prayed that it wouldn't be cold, so that I could turn back the collar of my coat and show my blouse with the crimpled white frill that I had ironed in Mrs. Flynn's kitchen while she was out. And I mustn't let him look at my shoes. The soles were patched, not too well. As I climbed the steps of the museum, my heart beat faster and faster. I was afraid he'd hear the heartbeats in my voice. But he wasn't there. I asked the guard at the door the time.
"Just 3, little one," he said kindly.
He wasn't coming. Oh, he wasn't coming. Then I saw a car stop at the curb. A great shining car. And he stepped out. The car moved away slowly, with the great lights on its polished guards and a chauffeur in tan livery driving. I hid behind the great door, trembling a little. And when at last he pulled it open, his face changed, and he smiled, and I saw his white, even teeth. I don't think we said anything to each other. He smiled,
That was all, and tucked my hand into his arms, and we went across the great corridors, where cold white figures of carved marble looked down on us. We were alone. That was all that mattered. We found a bench and sat down on it, and we turned and looked into each other's eyes.
"Tell me you've been thinking of me," he said slowly.
"Have you?" I faltered. He put his hand into his breast pocket and drew out my handkerchief. I smelled the faint perfume, violets and roses and honey-sweet meadows.
"Today you're going to tell me your name. R.L.F. R is for Rosamond, isn't it? But why did you run away from home?"
"I had to," I whispered the lie, not daring to lift shamed lids.
"You're used to open fireplaces and flowers and sunlight and ease. They used to bring you your breakfast on flowered plates with a sprig of sweet geranium on the tray." I stared straight ahead of me. I smelled the odor of damp floors and yellow soap in the farmhouse I'd called home until my mother died 6 years after father. I saw the oilcloth-covered tables, smelled the vapor of the oil lamp.
"Don't look like that," he said suddenly. Oh, for God's sake, you little lovely thing, don't think I'm a cad. But I can't ask you to marry me."
I sat there very still. It was as though he had torn out my heart and flung it down at his feet.
It was dim in the cool corridor. A cross on her white pedestal, a marble goddess looked down on us. Not more cold was her heart than mine was now.
"I've got to go back," I tried to say steadily.
"But you'll meet me again. Just once more. Say you will."
I was weak. His voice drained all my strength away, and the light in his eyes. I looked up at him. Next I knew he was kissing me, fire on my lips, a flame wrapped me round. And he caught both my wrists and held them tight.
I didn't want to leave him, ever. But I said goodbye at the top of the steps and promised that I'd meet him next day. Where it was all going to lead, I didn't know. I only knew I loved. He was a rich man from a different world. Somewhere I'd read a story about a king and a beggar maid. What happened then, I'm not quite sure. I was wrapped in a dizzy dream, and as I crossed the street, a sudden blinding force hit me. I felt myself whirled into a black chasm. I woke in a white room, and I cried out and sat up. I ached so.
"There, there now. You're all right," a cool voice told me. "Lie down like a good girl."
"Where?"
"In the hospital. You had an accident, but you're going to be all right." Little by little, I pieced it together. A motor car had run me down, and I was getting well in the hospital. I had been here 3 weeks. 2 weeks of them, my thoughts had been all hazy. I wonder if all the other had been a dream. A sick delirium. The man with the brown eyes and the velvet voice. Someone was speaking to me.
"Can you tell us now who you are and where you live?" the nurse asked.
Tears squeezed from beneath my lids. "I make wheat cakes in the window of a restaurant with the white tiles. I'm just Maisie. Maisie Smith. And both my parents are dead."
That afternoon they came to see me, the people who had knocked me down with their car, a mother and a daughter.
They brought me flaring red roses and a frothy thing of lace and silk to wear about my shoulders. I thanked them timidly.
"You're quite comfortable, my dear," the mother said.
I tried to thank her. She had white hair and a beautiful voice. I had never heard anyone talk like her before. She had pearls in her ears and pearls at her neck, and a great coat of fur that wrapped her softly.
Her daughter had black hair and black eyes and a white, sullen face. She pulled out a cigarette from a gold case at her wrist and said, lifting her brows, "Do you mind?"
"Mimi, I don't know whether she's quite well enough," her mother said.
Mimi crushed out the lighted cigarette with her toe. "Oh, mother, have you heard the Thayer scandal?" she said quickly. "He's married a shop girl, one of those girls behind a perfume counter. Pretty common little thing she is. Of course, it'll ruin his whole future. Socially, anyway."
Then they turned back to me.
"Is there anything," Mimi asked in her cool, lifted voice, "that you want?"
"Anything. I should like to get it for you."
I propped myself on one elbow, and my cheeks went hot with color.
"If you could get me a sweet geranium leaf."
"Why, my dear little thing, you shall have a whole geranium bush if you want it."
Then they had rustled out of the room, leaving a faint scent of violets and cigarette smoke and sachet-wrapped silks. I lay there very still after they had gone, smiling a little to myself, holding my love tight to my heart. What funny things they'd said.
"Pretty common little thing she is. Of course it'll ruin his whole future."
It was as though I had dipped suddenly into icy water. The water was coming closer about my heart, my throat. It was suffocating. I sat up straight in bed. "It'll ruin his whole future," I said it out loud. The nurse came into the room.
"Anything you want?"
"Will you tell me? Tell me, cross your heart, the truth. Am I a pretty common little thing?"
"Lie down now. Don't let's have any more of this silly talk," she said, and began to plump up my pillows and smooth the sheet across my cold hands.
I lay there very still with my eyes closed, but I was not asleep. I had to think it out. I might love him with all of me and work for him all my life, but I could never be anything but me. He was like them, like Mimi and her mother. His mother, too, rode behind liveried chauffeurs and ordered flowers from a florist and wore pearls about her white throat. If I loved him enough, I couldn't ruin his whole future. If I loved him enough.
Next morning, I had my breakfast on flowered plates, with a sprig of rose geranium crushed in my hot hand, and the sunlight poured through the window. Never as long as I may live shall I forget the scent of crushed geranium. It will always mean heartbreak and despair, and giving up this world, the thing you love the best. For I had given him up. He was a gentleman. I knew that from his voice and his hands, and I had seen the cigarette case set with his monogram and jewels. I used to send the roses and the orchids and the frail white lilies down the hall to the children's ward. I gave my frilled silk coat with its French rosebuds, to the young mother in the next room, whose husband came to see her every night. "She wanted to be pretty for him," she whispered to me once. But the little rose geranium plant bloomed beside my bed. I broke off one of its blooms for the old woman down the hall, who came from the country to see if they could save her eyes. Sometimes I used to hold her roughened hand while she talked to me.
"Rose geranium on the windowsill," I had, "and Aunt Jane's rocker beside it.
after the bacon was done of a Saturday, white loaves with dimpled brown crusts and pies of sliced apple and cinnamon pumpkin. I used to sit down there to get my breath for a bit. I can almost see it all, dearie, when I smell this crushed leaf in my hand. The sun's coming in warm on Jeremiah's seedlings, and the cat on the old Afghan in the corner. Jeremiah would come up the snowy walk and shout, "Get a good dinner for me, Ma. I got a heck of a lot of work to do." Somehow I felt, if I could see the country after I left the hospital, the wide sky and the fields, and a farmhouse snuggled down by the road, I might cry out my heartache. I said goodbye to Mimi and her mother, and the old lady from the country, and the mother with her downy-haired baby, and went back to make wheat cakes. They gave me back my job, but I didn't hold it more than of half a week.
"Listen here, kid," Joe said to me that first day. "You'd better get some of that bloom that comes in a little round box and put it on them white cheeks, and watch your step, or you'll get the go-by."
I did try, but day by day my feet dragged instead of getting quicker, and I kept watching all the gray-suited forms that came in and got mixed up on what I was doing. One night, when I was putting on my coat and hat, Joe came up to me.
"Say, the manager wants to see you. Now listen, if you ever want any help, you know who learned you how to turn your first row of wheats."
I felt weak and tired when I went to the manager. He told me that they wouldn't need my services anymore. I looked in the mirror as I went out. My eyes were too big for my face, and I saw the tears trembling on the lashes. Oh, God, what would I do now? I spent the next day looking for work, and the next, and the next, and the next. It was on the fourth morning that I met him. My knees felt like water when I saw him coming. I suppose it was weakness that made me go back to the window where I had worked to see who was Queen of Wheats now. He tucked my hand into his arm without a word. Love was stronger than I. "We're going to get breakfast first," he said, "and you're not allowed to say a word." I found myself following him into a hotel dining room, to a little table in the corner. We were all alone. I drank orange juice and ate oatmeal and cream and coffee. I felt strength begin to steal back in my body. "Rosamond," he said earnestly, "just for today, just this one day, will you come with me?"
I would have gone with him to the ends of the world, starved with him, died with him. He must have read it in my eyes. I gave myself into his hands. To the station, in a train, and then I was standing beside him on an icy platform, and he was speaking to me.
"I'm going to take you to meet my mother."
"Must you? Must I?"
He almost lifted me into a sleigh that stood by the road, and only when he had tucked the robe about me, and I heard the high tinkling notes of sleigh bells, did I understand. All the rest had been a dream. Our breakfast together, our trip on the cindery red velvet seat of the train. Now I was going to see his mother. That would be the end. I would read it in her eyes.
"A pretty common little thing."
He was holding both my hands in his. The sleigh stopped with the last peal of bells, and I stepped out stiffly. We were before a white house on the very side of the road, where a bent apple tree covered with feathers of snow, and the window panes glistening like icing glass in the frost, looked like a Christmas card. He put his arm about me, pounded on the door, and I stood there, breathless, agonized, praying that his mother would not answer. Then I was smiling up into the round, apple-cheeked face of a little old woman
with white hair brushed back into a wisp, and two fat little hands on her broad, comfortable woolen dress.
"If it ain't Jim and his girl!"
She put both her arms around me and kissed me. Jim drew me into the room with a shining Franklin stove and the rag rugs and the carved organ in the corner. He put both his arms on my shoulders. "Now, little lovely thing, you see my mother. Can you step down to marry me, just a plain farmer's boy who's gone to the city to make his way?"
"Is it true, Jim?"
I whispered. "But the case for your cigarettes with the diamonds and the big limousine?" Jim colored red.
"They gave it to me, the case, my boys, after the war. And the limousine, why, a chauffeur just picked me up. I fooled you, but I had to have you. I was afraid you wouldn't marry me if you knew."
"But would you marry me if you knew that my name is just Maisie Smith, that I spent 17 years on a farm, on a much poorer farm than this, and that's all there is to know?" The tears were running over my cheeks.
Jim pulled out his big, fresh handkerchief and wiped my eyes. Then he kissed me, first on one wet cheek and then the other.
"Thank God," Jim said. "That's all there is to know."
That was The Queen of Wheats, narrated by Brandi Tarvin. Swooning damsels and their heroic protectors might be a staple of the pulp genre, but I think it's refreshing to explore some of the other types of romance being published at the time. In this case, our story came from I Confess magazine, a publication targeted much more at women than other pulp titles by focusing on personal romantic tales instead of more speculative fare. It's an interesting facet of the period that's often overlooked, I think. And if you'd like us to explore it further, please drop by the site at protectingprojectpulp.com and leave a comment on the episode post, or join the conversation in the District of Wonders forum, linked from the site. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the show via iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Just click the subscribe link. And remember that the District of Wonders runs on your donations. There's no ads on the shows or on the websites. Instead, our sites have donation buttons and a big stack of hosting fees we need to pay. So please help us out, and we can continue to bring you great fiction at the very reasonable price of free. Thanks for listening, from everyone here at PPP. Our assistant editor, Fred Heimbaugh, our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, our producer, Tony C. Smith, and from me, your host, Simon Hildebrandt. We hope you'll join us next time for episode 42, where we'll bring you Adventurer's Heart, written by Albert Dorrington and narrated by Ben Boardman. Remember, you can find love anywhere, even at the counter of a diner, and have a great week.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.